Welcome to another episode of Just Another Bozo on the Bus. I'm your host, Paul Randack. This week, Bozo Roundtable number 9, I think.
Yeah. Whoa, really?
Episodes, yeah, number 9. Now, wow. I include the Bozos from Dover, which is the other.
Oh, gotcha.
We've done a couple of those. We've done two of those.
So. Perfect.
That means 7. This is the 7th of us. And then in a couple weeks, we're going to have the other roundtable on, too. So this is going to be a big roundtable time of year. Okay. So Corey, Robert Simpson, and Brett Heiner will be on then. Cool. All right. But let's go around and introduce ourselves. And we'll start with Mr. Shoddy.
I'm Zach Schottenstein.
True Minch. Brent Hansen.
The Shoddy Meister.
Yeah. I'm Brent, long-time listener, first-time caller.
Hey now.
Take my questions off the air.
Part-time rapper.
Exactly.
And I'm Sarah Robotham.
Robotham.
Every time I was waiting.
Yeah, right. You seem to get it right every time.
I know. It's amazing. Had some practice.
Okay. And I don't know what else we've got going on next month. I know Todd Sylvester's going to come back, and we're going to do one of our little discussions we do. And hopefully I'm going to have David Fresconi back on for a Fresconi file. That's sometime next month as well. I've had a great response to having Randall Carlisle on last week. He's been out and about. Obviously, he's always in the news because he reports the news. Used to, anyway. Now he works for Odyssey. But he's been speaking quite a bit publicly about his story. So it was really great to have him on. All right. Today, we're going to start with one of the most interesting topics, I think, if not one of the most difficult topics in recovery, is the issue of relationships and the dynamics of those, how they affect us. We've talked about in the past how relationships can be an addiction, just like to a drug or money or sex or whatever, the same kind of thing. And we can expect the same kind of thrill out of a relationship that we get from a drug as well. But relationships can also be a really healthy thing. So some of the questions are when's the right time? And I think that's something we all have probably some different thoughts or feelings about. And what to be careful of and what to watch for. And yeah, most of you have all had experience with this, so this should be a good, lively discussion. So who wants to start when we talk about relationships? Sarah's hiding her face.
I think that's a clear sign she needs to go first.
If I can't see you, you can't see me.
Take it away.
I was really hiding. Go ahead, Shoddy. You're in a great, stable relationship right now. How about you start, Sal? I'll go next.
The toughest thing with my relationship lately has been coming off my first relapse after being sober for nearly 2 years and finding how to approach building that trust back with my partner. It's difficult because, you know, I made the mistakes, and I find myself sometimes getting irritable when I feel the pressure that she, maybe not pressure, but when she asks me maybe how treatment's going, and maybe I get a little defensive because I don't want to talk about it, but that's been difficult this time around.
Well, you weren't in treatment when you got into this relationship. You're in aftercare.
Yeah, yeah.
Or kind of.
But I guess it just comes down to communication. Uh-huh. So I've had to be kind is the biggest thing, and express if I don't want to talk about something, just get that across to her, and she tends to respect that. And at first it was more difficult, but as we progressed, I mean, I was volunteering, you know, this is how everything's going, this is what my timeline's looking like, and that was much better than the
what the fuck is a timeline?
I guess like how long I'm gonna be in IOP.
I mean, what I imagined was, so you know, the timeline for the relationship.
Oh, no. But yeah, that was the biggest thing, the trust thing. But I think we've got that handled pretty well. Another relationship that I had to work with this time around was like my family relationship, like with my mother, mm-hmm. my father, my brother. Because when I was using again, I totally went backwards and wasn't communicating with them. And when I got clean, I guess it took a little bit of time to get back to where we were. So that's just something I've had to be conscious of. And, you know, it's the toughest with my stepdad is, that's always been a tough one, but we're in a good spot now and relationship solid. I think my relationships are going pretty well across the board.
We'll come back to the family relationships. Yeah. So I guess a lot of people that I know and come and ask me the question and wonder what your guys' thoughts are on this is when is it okay to begin to explore, you know, getting back into relationships? And what I mean by that is primarily a romantic type relationship. I mean, recovery and recovery community is all about, you know, creating relationships for support and connection. But when is it? When do you guys feel it's the right time to begin to explore, you know, the idea of looking at, you know, when's it okay or when's the time to explore when to enter into a romantic relationship?
Something for me that was a little different and hard. I mean, not different. A lot of people, I think, experience this, obviously. But when I went into residential treatment a little over 2 years ago, I was married, and so I was in a relationship. And so that in itself was challenging, and kind of what you're probably experiencing this time, Shoddy, is just because they always say, you know, don't get in a relationship right away, but what happens when you are already in one, you know? And
well, the thought is, well, don't get out of it unless it's an abusive relationship.
Right.
I mean, give yourself some time to get to know yourself as well, right. and see if it's something that can work out. But if it can't, then it's, you know, again, in that case, when's it time to move
right.
on?
Right. So, so, you know, that brings me obviously, I guess, to the next step of then you get out of that relationship and then is it, cause I don't really have an answer. I guess these are all just questions for myself as well, you know, cause then I get out of this relationship and have been sober for, you know, a chunk of time. And then am I going now like, all right, so I've been sober this long, or do I start basing things off of when my relationship ended? Or, you know, is it all just a personal when you feel like you've done self-work and you're ready to start making connection, like romantic relationship connections again? Mm. And I guess that's what I did, but...
How long was it?
Like 5 months. Between when our relationship ended and when I started dating again, okay. Casually dating.
Okay.
So, and then, I mean, that was months of just kind of, you know, dates here and there, not dating anyone exclusively. And then that was another.
Oh, you mean when you were doing research?
Yeah, I was just researching. The research went swimmingly.
One thing that I...
it was more about, I think, at the point of time for me was to start...
This is such an awkward conversation. I love it.
I know it's going to be. But I think for me, it was like, okay, let's start putting yourself out there again, because I was starting to get really comfortable and I was kind of ready to start putting myself out and meeting new people and having experiences where I was getting out of my comfort zone. And it doesn't, I mean, there's plenty of ways to do that, which I was also doing, aside from that, but that's kind of where I was at. And for another about 4 months, you know, I I just casually dated and didn't get into any relationships.
I think I took like almost a year from getting out of when I first went through treatment at Wasatch. I was in a relationship, figured out it wasn't healthy and ended it. And then I believe from the suggestion of you, you said, you know, maybe give it a year of being by yourself or with yourself. And I think I made it like 11 months. And then I met Whitney. Woo-hoo. Yeah. So I rounded up. And I thought that was a good time because the first like 3 months I was kind of in like, you know, a mourning phase and being like kind of sad and broody. And then the next, you know, 6 months I was in a good place getting to know myself again and being comfortable being with myself. And my friends helped a lot. And then, you know, the next couple of months, I think I started to feel like I was ready to explore that again. And I felt comfortable putting myself out there and, you know, getting to know another person. And shoot, it was just Whitney and we hit it off and it was awesome.
Mm-hmm.
But so you didn't have to do research like I did.
No, that time with myself was key. I always like to go back to that. I've had a couple instances of that in my life. Like when I was in college, I was on my own for a bit after a troubled relationship, and that was some really good time for me.
Yeah, no, I get that.
Yeah, I think as far as like the amount of time that you should take, really, I think it varies from individual to individual. Really, I think the key thing is what Sarah said and what you've also commented on, Zach, too, is you definitely need to take time to get to know yourself. And for some people, like myself, that's multiple years. For other people, it's 5 months. But it's like, yeah, you got to take that time to really feel, get to know yourself, feel comfortable being alone. And I think if you're not trying to pursue a romantic relationship early in recovery, it forces you to make those friendships that you commented on, Zach, with other people and with, you know, and make those connections that are so healthy for recovery. If you're not focused on, you know, one person and being in an intimate relationship with one person, it basically kind of forces you to branch out and make multiple connections and multiple friends. And I think that's really what's important, not so much a time. Like, I know, I think and I could be wrong, but I think, you know, in my familiarity with AA and the 12 steps, they like no relationships for a year type situation. At least that's what it was relayed to me. And I don't think you can really put a time limit on it, or I think it's just individual. But the important thing is to get to know yourself in early recovery, because you've been in your addiction for so long that you really have lost, you know, at least for me, I lost complete touch of who I really was. And I've said this before, I look back on that time period and it's like, I don't even almost recognize that person, that guy. I'm like, who was that guy? You know, and now that I've had some time to really, you know, be able to grow and again, be comfortable with myself. I see too many times, I think, people in early recovery jump into an intimate relationship and it kind of fucks things up. I'd be weary about jumping in it too early, but I wouldn't say that you have to be, you know, you have to be in recovery for over a year. It's just, I think it's whatever feels right, you know. Now I'm getting to the point where it's getting to the point where I'm too comfortable with myself. I like, not really. Now I don't, you know, right.
I'm too comfortable with myself.
Yeah, yeah.
What the hell is that?
Well, it means like, it's like, oh, do I want to start dating again? And it's like, no, not really. I think I'm good, you know. I got good friends. I don't know, because relationships in general are a lot of work, right? So for me, I think I need to work on not being so lazy about that concept of it.
Depends on the relationship.
That's though. True.
And yeah. It also depends on why we're in the relationship, which goes back to this idea of, am I doing it because I need some type of validation? Like, is that where I get my nourishment from, is the validation of others? And if there's, when is it time? I mean, because I want to answer that question, then you can answer, then you can respond to this one. Is it's time when I don't need to have the validation anymore from someone externally to be, feel okay about who I am. I think that's when we do, or at least for me, we do discover, or I did discover who I was. It doesn't mean that I'm not going to, I mean, that's a lifelong journey, right? So it's going to continue on, hopefully. Because I was told 2 years. I mean, someone told me, you should, I think in your case, you should wait a couple years mm-hmm. before you get into a relationship. And I made it 18 months, and I went right back to old behaviors. I mean, I was, some of the stuff that I was doing, I was like, I was really surprised by. I was going back into debt. I was, making choices. I started to keep secrets and,
codependency crept in.
That dependency piece, like all of a sudden, finding myself becoming a bit of a caretaker, and that was not healthy. But I got validation out of being the caretaker. That's what. And when I noticed that, I realized that I had probably jumped a little bit early. But hell, that was 22 years ago, and I'm still married.
And I think, for me, one piece about the working on yourself thing. And I know it is different when you're all on your own. But for me, I still believe in that I was working on myself so much that was actually one of the things that ended my marriage and yeah. relationship. It's not like we got divorced and then I started my self-work. I was doing that for a long, long time before.
That's true.
So I would say from my last relapse of October 2017 until April when I moved out, that whole time I was spending so much time on myself and my self-care and recovery and finding out what I needed mm-hmm. and for myself and mm-hmm. in a relationship, that really was kind of the downfall of us because I was starting to play a different role in our relationship and at no fault to either of us. But that wasn't who I was, but it's who I became comfortable with and happy mm-hmm. with and refused to change, which is, one of the things, reasons that it didn't work out. But, I think there are exceptions to sometimes, and, the whole being alone, like I felt more alone at the end of that part than I did once I actually was on my own, yeah.
Well, isn't that...
So there's a lot of growth during that time. The last, I'd say, 6 months of our relationship, that was actually one of my biggest growing periods of and self-discovery and everything. So,
well, I think that's the importance of self-care, or at least the notion of being able to, even if I'm in a relationship at that time, being able to focus on myself. And that's why we say mm-hmm. don't necessarily end a relationship. I mean, that is some general advice, unless there's, abuse of some kind or... there's some other form of unhealthy dynamics that are paranoia, jealousy, controlling behaviors and those kinds of things. But the idea of being able to differentiate from the relationship that we're in so that we our self-care and our well-being becomes the priority, we can kind of find out pretty quickly what the dependency issues and the dynamics are in the relationship.
Yeah.
Which is kind of what I hear you saying.
Exactly, yeah. And that became really apparent the more... I took a look at myself for the first time and, was able to release some of that codependency and be able to see myself a little bit more clearly in the role I was playing and that I did not want to be playing anymore, that I didn't feel proud about that role. And then, interestingly enough, like recently, getting into another relationship, very recently with someone that... I felt like we were both on the same page of having done a lot of that work on ourselves and everything. And even with that being the case, it was crazy how quickly I fell into a pattern of, again, being a fixer, kind of like what you were saying, Paul. And
the dependency
getting some,
on the dynamic and the role.
Right. And it wasn't the validation of, like, for me, it wasn't a validation of, oh, I need to be in a relationship to feel whole. That hasn't really been a thing for me, but
or someone needs to validate, but you didn't feel that.
No, I didn't. Yeah. I didn't feel like I needed to be validated. That is one thing that I learned in myself growth was, not needing as much of that mm-hmm. external validation. However, something was obviously feeding that old habit of you are feeling broken and I can fix it and I can make it better. Mm-hmm. And without even realizing it, because we'd had a long friendship, all of a sudden I was doing the same thing I had done in my past relationship that I swore I had grown out of, you know. And, you know, luckily, sounds weird, luckily, but, you know, that ended in a way that made me have to look at that again. And also had he looked at that as well and mm-hmm. didn't want to play the role that he was playing either.
Right.
And right. for both of us to be able to kind of be hurt and take a step back and go, wow, we were both playing roles mm. that neither of us wanted ourselves or the other to play, but we just fell into that. Like, wow, we really need to keep that in check and become aware of that and why we were doing that. And take some accountability.
So. This is, I just realized as we're talking about this, it's equally as important to understand when it's time to end a relationship too, which, you know, I mean, I can say for, you know, everyone I know, basically that becomes as much of a dilemma or something as difficult to do as finding how to coexist in a healthy relationship without becoming, you know, more shame-based or needy or fear-based or, you know, that needing to consume external validation, you know, mainline it per se, you know, in simple little things like, you know, always saying I love you to someone, and the expectation is the response will be, I love you too. Because that's, you know, I mean, I used to ask that question. I used to say that just so someone would say it back to me. And it was an interesting dynamic. I realized this is long, long time ago, but it was one that was, I felt a little kind of shocked when I realized I wasn't saying it to express necessarily my love towards someone else, but hoping that someone would validate that they loved me as well. I don't know if that makes sense to you guys or not, but that was it. Anyway, back to when is it time to end a relationship, which is what I heard you saying. You didn't immediately get out of your relationship. You decided to do some work.
Yeah, we worked
on it
for a little over a year.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so I think as much as, you know, relationships ending are always hard, I can't speak for him, but I personally felt like I had done what I needed to do to feel at peace with the ending of the relationship. At the beginning, when I went to treatment, mm-hmm. thinking, oh my God, if he leaves me, my life is going to be over. And that was, you know, the epitome of codependency and everything, you know, right. Like I won't be able to live if he leaves me. Mm-hmm. And then getting to this point of self-realization and growth and realizing I would like a partner in my life, I don't need a partner if it's not the right one. Mm-hmm. And so it was hard, but I felt fairly at peace with it when it was time mm-hmm. to be over and felt like we had both put forth the work that we needed to, and we just couldn't get back on the same page of being okay with these new roles that,
sure.
you know, I would need to feel comfortable in. And it wasn't a lack of love, you know, I've talked to many people about this, and I didn't fall out of love with him necessarily. It was, I loved him a lot, and I still do, you know, in a way. But it was doing what was best for me.
Yeah.
And that took me some time. But once I did, it felt right.
Well, and there's also a process here that's maybe about falling back in love with ourselves, too.
Definitely.
That creates this sort of catapult towards change. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think we see it. I like that. The it can be very difficult to determine when it's time to get out of a relationship. You know, it seems like of all the aftercare groups I've been to, there's always at least one person in the group that's struggling with that issue of like when. You know, we know this relationship is toxic, but so when are you going to end it? When are you going to get out of it? And they can't. And I've been in that position myself too, so I can have some empathy there. But yeah, that's something that's very challenging to do, is when it's time to end it. And I mentioned this a couple weeks ago about the acceptance component of that, and sometimes, you know, having acceptance doesn't mean that you have to be passive about it. Like, oh, I'm just going to accept this miserable relationship. You know, sometimes that acceptance component is, I accept that this relationship's not going to go forward, or this relationship doesn't serve me well and is not working for me. So it's time to make a change. But it can be very challenging to come to that realization. For me personally, a lot of it was fear of like Sarah said, like, oh my gosh, my life is going to end if I don't have this person in my life, or I'm never going to meet anybody else again. You know what I mean? That's like this, or, you know, I'm just going to be alone the rest of my life if I get out of this relationship.
And isn't that partly this idea of no one will love me because I don't really love myself?
Exactly. That's what I was going to say. And all that's happening because I'd never taken the time to do that, to try to develop that self-love and to get away from that need for validation and get away from that need to be a caretaker, you know? And mm-hmm. so once you can move forward from that, then yeah, it's a little bit easier to be like, this relationship is not serving me well. It's not going to be healthy for me or the other person if we move forward. So it's time to move on. It can be very difficult though.
How'd you do that?
How did I? Basically, just you draw a line in the sand, you know, and you just say, you know, I love you and I'll always be here for you, but this isn't going to work out. You know, a lot of people, again, we've talked about this before. A lot of times when people are in these toxic relationships and it's time to end it, it's like, okay, they do the blow it up the approach where it's just like, all right, I'm done with you. You're out of my phone. You know, I'm cutting all ties from you and I never want to talk to you again. And it's a complete severing. For me, it wasn't that I didn't feel comfortable with that approach. It was more like I'm not going to be able to be in an intimate relationship with you anymore. I will be your friend, but I can't be in an intimate relationship with you, and we can't continue to try to make this work because it's just not working. And you just, yeah, you have to just break it off, you know, essentially. So, I don't know. There's two methods. The blow-up method.
Yeah, the blow-it-up, which is...
The blow-it-up.
The scorched earth.
Yeah, right?
Scorched earth. Burn everything to the ground.
Or there's the other approach, which is hopefully you can still remain civil and, sure. and remain friends.
And, of course, I could do that, or you can do that. But if the other person wants to blow it up, they still can. I mean, sure. this is the reminder that we don't ever have control over anyone else but ourselves. So,
yeah, that's true.
Yeah, and sometimes, you know, even the conversation with ourselves, can be difficult to maintain. We may know it's the best thing. It's just actually, literally, stepping in and setting those boundaries can still seem very difficult. And challenging. It's partly because it's uncomfortable, you know. And I think you said it well, Brent, when you said that. Will anyone ever love me again? Will there be anyone else out there in the world? You know.
Yeah. Exactly.
So I always like the numbers. This comes down to a thing of numbers. So if it's one in a million, that means there's at least 70,000 people out there that would fit the profile.
Right. Exactly.
And the other question is, you know, that ties into this. I don't want to get too far off, but this notion, you know, in early recovery, would I have dated myself?
Oh, God, no. But what's funny now is I'm always like, oh, if I could just date myself, like someone, you know, like now I'm to the point of almost egotistical, like I'm so great that if I could just find someone just like me.
I'm so awesome.
Kind of kidding, kind of not. Yeah.
You ended a relationship, you were saying. How did you do that?
I don't think I've ever done the scorched earth policy, as Brent was talking about, nor do I ever really go into it trying to be friends, because I personally, that's tough on me. I say my piece, like Brent said, you know, I'll always care for you, have love for you, and but I'm going to go my separate way, and I wish you the best, more or less. And with my long-term ex-girlfriend that I had when I lived in Florida, she, you know, she ended things with me, and, you know, we went for quite some time without speaking, And then all of a sudden, out of nowhere, she starts, you know, reaching out and stuff to me. And when it becomes like that was very difficult to me because I still cared about her and stuff like that. So at that point, I did have to like sever ties with her. I had to, you know, after communicating several times, like, this is very selfish of you, you know, to put this on me, these feelings that you're still having when I'm trying to move along with my life. Excuse me. And then at the end of that, sorry,
getting a little choked up. Are you?
No, I'm fine.
Need some water.
Or? I had to tell her, listen, I can't be in contact with you anymore. This isn't good for me. And eventually I had to, you know, block her on her phone number. And, you know, I haven't heard from her since, but.
That you blocked her?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. It's funny how that works, right?
No ghost calls from someone else's number?
So, okay. I mean, word on the street is she's getting married and all that, and I'm very happy for her. And but I had to put my boundaries down and stay with them for me. Because it's tough, you know, when you hear from someone that you had such a deep connection with for quite some time, it's just hard to, when they come back in your life just abruptly and, you know, say sometimes, you know, not hurtful stuff, but stuff that evokes like strong emotions from the past. It's very difficult for me, at least. And it's frustrating.
Interesting. I was thinking about the relationship that you were in before you met Whitney.
You know, that one.
Because you ended that, right?
Or no? Yeah, you know, and coming to like knowing when the right time is, I don't think, I just felt it, you know, and I shared it with some close friends, and you know, I said my piece and she responded, and that might have been the most healthy breakup I've ever had in my life. She respected my boundaries, I respected hers. Actually, recently I was with my current girlfriend Whitney, and we ran into her downtown, and it was very civil, very nice. I've never had that. And it was kind of cool to see, you know, wish her the best and hear how she's doing and genuinely, you know, feel like happy for them. And
nice.
It was cool. Yeah, it was different from the college years, which were more scorched earth.
Scorched earth policy. Yeah. So a little some rainbows and unicorns on this one a little bit. Huh?
So.
All right.
Well, one other thing that I've been thinking about that does involve relationships, and this is something that came from you that you and I talked about and that you talked to someone else about, that I'm trying to be very aware of right now, is the idea of romantic love and infatuation, you know, that type of thing, versus real
selfless
love.
Yeah.
And that's, I feel like that's a hard one to decide. I didn't think it was going to be a hard one to decipher. And I'm glad my awareness is up on it, but it's still, when you are in something new, even if it's someone you've known for a long time, there's still a level of excitement and newness. And so that's something, like, I don't know if you guys have experienced, but trying to figure out how do I remain aware of, is this something that, because I think it's okay. I mean, I look at my parents, for example. I mean, they still have romantic love, and they've been married for 40 years. You know, I mean, yeah, over 40 years now. So I think it's okay to have that. Mm-hmm. But, you know, I think it's actually healthy to have that in a real relationship. But I don't know. I feel like early on, it does feel real. And sometimes, at least. And so how do you, you know, how do you figure out, is this really something that could be a real long-lasting relationship, you know, and maintain this romantic love as well, versus something that, okay, this is just romantic love, this is going to fizzle and fade when this stage of the relationship is over.
Mm-hmm.
I think it just takes time. I mean, I don't know. Every new relationship, at least romantically or intimately, has that level of excitement. And it's like we've talked about it before, how it's that feeling's addicting, right?
It's like a drug.
It is. It's like a drug, and that can be very addicting. And so that's going to happen with almost every relationship that you get into in that manner. And so only, you know, you're going to have to just ride that wave, I think. You just ride that wave. And then once that kind of fizzles out, it's like, well, do we have something real here or not?
We have something more withstanding through the mundane
exactly.
times? Exactly.
Yeah. Usually the first crisis is a good sign, too. The first time that you guys really, you know, butt heads, it's like, you know, can you work through it? Or, you know, how much suffering goes into that, resolving that crisis, you know? I think, it definitely is hard to, early in a relationship, hard to determine whether or not this is just infatuation, or is this going to be selfless love for a long period of time?
That has the potential for long-term success.
I'm in the same boat. I don't know what's going on with my throat, but that honeymoon phase, so to speak.
Yeah, mm-hmm. yeah, yeah.
You ride that out and see what's on the other. You just stick to it, and if there's nothing there, it's when you got to start asking the questions.
Right.
Like,
right.
What are you doing? What are you getting out of this? But also, after that honeymoon phase, so to speak, if there's like a mundane time where there's like a lapse, I mean, there's times where, you know, it'll get romantic again. I'm dealing with that currently, you know, but it's fine. We have, you know, times where we're just, I'm happy to be with her and she's happy to be with me, and then we get romantic and do nice things, but I don't think it's got to be a constant.
Yeah, I definitely agree.
One thing that stands out to me is in the book that we've been reading for our book club, Dan Harris, 10% happier, right? Mm-hmm. Yeah, 10% happier. He quotes a Woody Allen movie in there, and he's talking about relationships, and he says that relationships are like sharks. They have to continue to be moving forward or they die. And then he says, and what we have here on our hands is a dead shark. Yeah. So, I think that's true. I mean, when I said earlier, relationships are a lot of work. And I think that they are, even if you have two very healthy people in there, I mean, the relationship always has to be moving forward or it's gonna die. And that doesn't mean that you always have to be moving forward constantly, but you got to be able to move forward through those mundane kind of cycles, the ups and downs, you know?
Yeah. Personally, when I'm in those, like, you know, funks where it kind of feels, I don't know, not very exciting, so to speak, I just know it's gonna, you know, it's gonna get better. But that's an interesting...
Except when it doesn't.
Yeah, yeah. Most of the time. But I like that shark moving forward thing, keeping water on the gills.
And I think that's realistic. And I mean, from my past experiences, I've had two long-term relationships, and I feel like that was true for those as well. Was, you know, obviously they ended at some point when the shark died.
Yeah.
But...
I don't like to, like, stop and... you know, think about, oh man, this is not great right now. Then I get obsessive.
Yeah. So. And then.
Yeah, the shark dies.
And I guess, again, you don't have any control over the other person ever. Mm-hmm. So if they haven't experienced that, really, that's just going to be something for them to learn to get through or not.
Yeah. When you say, like, relationships are a lot of work, some are. Like, I've had those past relationships seem to be, like, a lot of work on my part, but. And the one that I'm in now, I'm like relieved that I have like a partner to help me with that lifting. Mm-hmm. And it's cool to be able to lean on them instead of relying all on yourself. So I've noticed that, and that's what reiterates that I'm in a healthier relationship than I've been in the past currently.
Definitely.
All right, that gives me hope. I like that.
Well, that's why we did this. Yeah. This is,
very good.
This was an intervention for you.
Very good.
No, it's not. What to say about relationships? The thing about romantic love it's supposed to be like a spark. It's supposed to be something that ignites the dynamics of a relationship, but it is not something that can sustain a relationship. Meaning that if one expects there always to be a romantic, a love experience that's, deep into the midbrain, and it's why it's compared to Helen Fisher, the doctor and psychologist said that, she compares it to cocaine. It fires in the same parts of the brain and the pleasure centers, and the brain gets used to it, and then it says, why can't relationships always be like this? And then we become obsessive and compulsive about it, and it becomes an addiction. It also is when the victim comes out of that. So if somebody doesn't do something the way we hoped they would, we can often become victimized by that person because they're not meeting the needs of what our story about romantic love is. And so, being in a relationship requires taking, I must take ownership of that. I must be willing to not blame the other person if I put myself in a situation that it's not reciprocated. That the expectation that someone's always going to reciprocate that, okay, I'll just say it. It's irrational thinking. Mm-hmm. Even though I want to believe that it's possible, I don't know if it's really healthy to depend upon that, and again, selfless love is one where we, things like jealousy and control and fear don't reside. They get more attached to, I think, the energy around romantic love because of it's so highly charged. Selfless love, I give up control. I give up control because I can't control anyone else. It would be nice, but it's not real, Just like I can't control my kids. Though I did try for years and years and years. All right. So the next topic for discussion today's Bozo Roundtable is balance. And what we mean by balance, I guess, or at least for the discussion, is, between the different aspects of our lives, especially when it comes to recovery, how much is focused on the treatment and the therapeutic part of it, and how much is focused on, resourcing community and stepping outside just our regular support communities that have to do with recovery. Do we get to hang out with people that aren't in recovery and aren't focused on necessarily sobriety in the same way that that you may be? So and I suppose this is about a balance of we can look at that from a relational dynamic too, is the idea of self-care, which is probably one of the most important things for everyone involved in life. Okay, we're opening it up. Who wants to jump in first?
I guess I'll take it. I've been struggling with balance between treatment and self-care and my relationship, because last time I went through IOP, I was single, so I had a lot more time to focus on just staying, active and working out, because that's a big part of my identity and it's very therapeutic for me. But this time around, having a relationship and going to IOP 3 nights a week and working full time, it's been really difficult for me to find time for myself, whether it be to sit down and watch a TV show that I like, go to the gym, really anything. I've been struggling with that, and I've kind of been feeling negative about just my health. I mean, I went to the doctor and they said I was, healthy as a horse, but I mean, I just don't feel that way, and I have to, work on reframing how I'm looking at treatment to include giving myself what I need physically and nutritionally too, because I've been eating like shit, just whatever I can get.
What do you mean, whatever you can get?
Like baby burritos.
Like a baby-sized burrito that I ate before this.
Yeah, baby.
Yeah. So that's been tough for me this time around.
What's the tough part about it? What do you notice where the most of the angst is coming from?
Not being able to get into the gym and work out on a regular, like 3-4 times a week. I've done that since I was like 15 years old. It's instead of meditating, that is my meditation. I really enjoy just zoning out and doing that. And I haven't been able to make time for that. I've been using excuses like, oh, you worked, you know, 10 hours today. You went to 3 hours of treatment, you know, just take it easy. And then on the weekends, I guess I just make excuses like, oh, let's go to breakfast and sleep in and all that. And
I deserve it.
Yeah, just bullshit like that.
Well, isn't that self-care?
I guess so, yeah. Taking time to sleep and, you know, going out and enjoying the company of my wonderful girlfriend. And, doing stuff with her that, you know, she would like to do because it's a, you know, symbiotic relationship. Yeah, I guess I just have been feeling like I've been neglecting myself and that balance. But that's good. That I didn't even think of it that way. Maybe I am. I'm just so, you know.
So you have an expectation of what it's supposed self-care is supposed to look like. You really tied it into the gym, right?
That's it. And I've been doing all this other stuff like snowboarding and rock climbing and walking the dogs, and that's another form.
You've been snowboarding and rock climbing?
Yeah. And I don't even equate that.
So, interesting.
I don't know.
Well, this argument kind of broke down.
Yeah,
really
I kind of shit the bed on that one. I'm gonna pass it along.
Congratulations on your self-care, Zach.
Yeah, you sound like you're doing great, and congratulations on your self-awareness.
Oh my god,
you were blowing smoke up your own ass.
No, I think balance,
which is a talent in itself. Oh,
absolutely. Absolutely. Would we call that self-care? I don't know.
The smoke?
Yeah. No, I think self-care can take many forms, as we've discovered, you know. But I think you mentioned one thing that I think is key for balance, at least for me in my life, is the sleep component.
Mm-hmm.
I've found that in recovery, I have been able to really capture that sleep component back in my life, where I am getting, you know, going to bed at a reasonable hour, getting up, and when I get up in the morning, I feel good. You know what I mean? I feel rested and feel ready to take on the day. If I start to balance, you know, start staying up till 2:30 in the morning, binging on something TV wise or whatever, I really feel the effects of it the next day. And so I think for me, life balance, I can't neglect that sleep component of it.
No, that's a good point. I feel like I've been neglecting the sleep part of it a little bit. The weekdays I'm pretty good because I wake up at 5:30 for work, and so I am pretty good. I have the pattern of I need to get to bed at a certain time, but then for me it's the weekend where I'm making excuses like, well, it's the weekend and I just worked my ass off all week, so now I can, you know, I need to like make up time or something, because I feel like when I'm working 12 hours I get home and I'm just like a, you know, I don't want to do anything. I just want to, because I'm only home awake for a couple hours, you know, so I want to take my bubble bath and, you know, like watch a show, do that little piece of self-care. So then when the last few weeks, I feel like by the time the weekend hits, then I like want to make up for lost time. And so I stay up later, like hanging out with people or wanting to watch a show. And
I have to be careful.
And then I'm
that.
Exhausted because I still wake up decently early. Yeah. I have a hard time, you know, with my internal clock and...
Mm-hmm.
So I've definitely been feeling the last few weeks like I'm always trying to catch up. Then I'm like, well, I can nap later today, and I never have to, you know, I shouldn't be allowing myself to try and play this catch-up game.
I nap every weekend. It's amazing.
Yeah. I love naps too, but I don't always have time.
You never did which part?
Naps. My meemaw used to make me nap when I was growing up on vacation.
So
I'd be like, what the hell are we doing?
I want to live life. Carpe diem.
She was on to something.
I know. I wish people would force me to take naps now.
Oh my god. But I have to be careful with thinking about, like, you know, I work so hard all week, I deserve this, because I used to do that with alcohol.
Yeah, right.
I would be like, oh, man, you deserve it. You know, you didn't hit the bottle too hard this week. You got everything done. You don't have to do anything else this weekend except get, you know, fucked up. Mm-hmm. Watch football.
Yeah, I saw that too.
So get fucked up and watch football.
Except for minus the football.
American
Pie, definitely
the
fucked up part.
Yeah. I mean, I'd just be getting fucked up.
Besides
be honest.
Yeah, I mean, yeah. Were you really paying attention to the football? No. At that point, probably not. But
but that I have to be careful with.
What was the score of that game? I don't know.
Nah, he won another screwdriver, man.
Yeah.
All right.
The part that you mentioned at the beginning for me, that kind of something I haven't thought of a lot lately, but the balance you're saying between, you know, recovery and maybe your relationships within recovery versus your relationships with people outside of mm-hmm. recovery. Mm-hmm. And for me, that isn't always a huge factor, because a lot of my, I have a great group of friends that I'm still incredibly close with, that I've known some since elementary, most since junior high, and a few since high school.
Well, yeah, you got a
yeah. So I've got this really solid group of friends that I've remained incredibly close with, which is amazing. The one factor for me that makes it a little easier is that most of my closest friends live out of state, and so there's not the need to balance a lot of that time. But it does pop up here and there, and I have noticed that it's harder for me to give as much to those relationships as I used to when they were my only solid friendships. Like, I'm so incredibly grateful for all of my friendships and connections I've made in recovery and the communities I'm a part of. And it's one of the most important things in my life now, and one of my biggest priorities. And I think that's great, and it's incredibly positive, but there are things, like, even a friend tonight who's having a birthday party. Her husband texted me over a week ago, and I was like, well, Saturday night, I've got refuge recovery to go to, you know? And so here I am thinking, well, I can either go to refuge, or I go to refuge every week. I can just go to this party. And I decide finally, well, it's starting at 6, the party, but how about I come at 7:45, 8, or 8 and make both? And that's what I'm doing. And now I feel good about that. But it's, or even, you know, staying in contact with those friends. Like, I've had two of my very best friends, one who lives in England and one who lives in Colorado. Both we've been texting this week. Just my closest great friends. And opening up to them about things feels a little bit more challenging than it used to. Mm-hmm. They were always my go-to, and now I've been opening up, you know, to these other friendships, like these two guys here, you know, and just realizing it's okay to have that. You know, maybe there are certain things that I reach out to certain people for, and there are other people that, you know, I reach out for other things. Or I guess just realizing that I don't have to choose, and I don't have to have some of my relationships not mean as much just because I've gained these, you know, really new great friendships. But I think it's been a good lesson for me a little bit on finding balance of,
yeah,
all those things.
Well, and it's the idea of learning to be vulnerable outside of just the community, just the, you know, the community that maybe been in, that, you know, you've been involved with for a long period of time, you know, for a few years, and a lot of that's maybe the sober support community, but learning to be vulnerable, you know, with outside that, whether it be coworkers, you know, friends, family, you know, being vulnerable with family and being able to work through issues there, and finding some kind of balance to this. It all comes back down, I think, seriously, it comes back down to being able to find and maintain some sort of balance, and not just being able to, I mean, probably we probably should have brought, not should have, fuck that. We probably could have brought up, when we're talking about relationships, the notion of just becoming, like, really vulnerable with one person, you know, and how toxic actually that can be. Mm-hmm. That if, you know, that everything gets tied into that, and then all of a sudden we kind of lose sort of some of these other connections, which is what can happen,
mm-hmm.
right?
Yeah.
It can often lead to isolation. So I just did, I guess. So threw that back in there, doing a little fishing.
Rope it back in. All right. Yeah. It's I find myself sometimes not wanting, like, it's going to be harder, take more effort to open up to people, even though they've known me a good share of my life, about certain things now, because I'm always like, oh, well, they don't totally understand. So it's probably easier just to, you know, communicate these things with people who have been through similar, you know, even if it has nothing to do with alcohol or recovery or, you know, but just life things in general. I just kind of feel like, because we've all communicated so openly during different groups and things like that, that it's easier to communicate with people like that now than to have to. But then the times I have opened up and communicated with them, my, you know, older friends, they're, you know, amazing. And it's great, you know, and they have different perspectives. And it's a good reminder for me to not, you know, isolate to, I can only talk to these people because they really, you know, have known the deeper side, or, you know, like.
It's, they're my tribe.
I mean, they are, but yeah.
No, it's true, though.
Yeah. You know, but I can't, but I shouldn't be judging, well, they won't understand, because right. Who cares if they do or don't? Yeah. They're still great friends and are there for support, just like I am for them, and I don't understand. You know, a couple of them are moms now, and so they have stuff that they come to me with that I don't totally understand, and they know that, where they could be like, well, I'm only going to talk to other people who are parents, you know, and right. And I, you know, so it's, yeah.
Yeah, I think it can be challenging. It was for me, especially when I started to, once I did get sober and was working in recovery, to open up to some of those relationships that I had had previously. And because we do fall into a kind of a comfortability, is that a word?
It is.
A comfort zone of being able to be vulnerable and open up to our recovery community. Mm. And then, and it feels, that's a safe, you're in the trust tree.
Yeah,
that's
true.
Are we not?
And you get outside of that, and it's like, it can be challenging, but there's been few things that I've had in recovery that have been more rewarding than going back and making those connections with those lifelong friends that I've had, and letting them know where, you know, how my life has gone, and the journeys that I'm on, and the challenges and the circumstances that I've had to face and overcome, and feel their support and their love, and, you know, it even deepens our friendship. But it can be challenging at first, definitely. But you can really never have too many friends, right?
I don't think so. I don't know.
I know.
But there's a, you know, we're not talking like Facebook friends, right?
No, I'm talking about real, like, yeah, real true connected friends, you know? And so you can have that in our recovery tribe, but you can also expand that out and balance that out with people that you've known for your entire life, that you've been lifelong friends with, and keep them involved in your life. It's been very rewarding for me, at least.
Yeah. And it becomes an important part of just having a foundation to work from, too. I mean, absolutely. Friendship and community, I mean, it's really the basis of living a wholehearted life, right? Is this notion of being connected and being vulnerable within a community that of people that one can trust us and we can trust them and know what to expect. Yeah.
Definitely.
All right. Yeah. Were we gonna hit, do you guys want to, anything else you want to do on this one, or you want to jump in for a few minutes on our last topic, at least give it a
give it a what for?
A shot, a what for? We can outline. We can begin this. This one will probably have a few different segments to it, but because we're talking about meditation, we're going to talk about meditation for a little bit, and more like meditation 101. How do I start? When do I start? And why do I want to meditate? I mean, maybe we could explore, you know, those three things. You know, how do people get started, and you know, what's your advice on that based upon your experience? You know, is there a better time to learn to do this than not, and why do I want to meditate?
Yeah, I think first thing that a lot of times when that question gets brought up, well, how do I meditate? I think the best thing to say first is there's no wrong way to really meditate. And there's no right way, really, to meditate. For me, personally, and I think a lot of times, and I was introduced to this word just this week. Somebody was like, oh, so you do transcendental meditation?
Yeah, transcendental meditation.
And I'm like, what's it? I don't know what that word means, but sure. I mean, I don't know. What does that mean? You know, explain that to me. And so, yeah, for me, meditation is more just sitting quietly, and I'll either focus on my breath or I will focus on a certain, I don't know, what would you call it? Like, it's not really a mantra or a something that I want to bring attention to, you know, essentially, something that I want to focus my attention on. Sometimes that's just, you know, may I have acceptance, you know, and something or something like that. And you can, and you start out, for me, it was just starting out by, you know, finding a comfortable place. A lot of it started through refuge recovery, because in refuge recovery, meditation is such a strong component of it. And that then led into an individual practice of meditation. But really, it's just sitting quietly and working to focus your mind on one thing. And usually it starts out with just focusing on the breath. And, you know, just trying to clear your mind. And when because as we go throughout our daily lives, our minds are always like racing, thoughts coming in and out. And you're thinking about the future, the past, and very rarely are you thinking about the actual present. And so to be able to kind of try to filter all of that out and just kind of focus your mind on one particular subject or one thing. And
when you say, Brent, when you say focus on your breath, do you want to explain what that means? Because I can hear some of our listeners going, well, what part of my breath do I focus on? The sound it's making?
You know, no,
do I breathe in
point.
And out?
Yeah,
do,
that's a good
do
point.
Do I slow down my breath? I mean, how does that work for you?
Yeah, so it's just an awareness that you're breathing. And, you know, when your mind starts to wander or think about something else, you just bring that, you try to bring that attention back to the fact that you're just breathing.
Mm-hmm. And I think sometimes in the beginning, I don't think it's necessary, but if it helps, every once in a while, if I'm having a really hard time focusing, actually focusing on my in and out can help me.
Yeah, absolutely.
And so I don't think, especially when you practice it a little bit more often, I think it's just the breathing is pretty natural and you don't have to really focus on the in and the out. But I know when I'm having a hard time focusing, sometimes literally thinking the words in and out and really paying attention to where in my body I'm feeling, is it my stomach or my chest or my nostrils, you know, where it's coming in and out from.
Right.
Helps me maintain a little bit more focus. So that might help early on.
And I can say just quickly for myself is when I started this is I would count off how long I breathe in and out. I mean, I learned this from my yoga practice as well, was the, you know, six, counting to six on the breath in and counting to six on the breath out, which can be a little long for some people. So starting out with a smaller number, three or four or five or something, can help. And that idea of just focusing on that, and then as you know, breathing in, I'd also separate breathing in with my nose and breathing out with my mouth, also helped to focus on breathing before I would eventually brought sound into it as well. So, you know.
Yeah, again, really no wrong way to do it. You know, there's different variations. I think a lot of times, though, too, that I think it's worth mentioning is people can get frustrated with meditation because they're trying to focus on either the breath or focus on just one or being aware of one thing. But the mind won't let you do that. The mind's racing and you're having all these thoughts come in and thoughts come out and a thought will trigger a memory and then you get lost in the memory while you're sitting there trying to meditate and it can be frustrating. And so the thing to always remember is just be very forgiving and kind to yourself and recognize, okay, yep, my mind wandered there, but I'm going to come back to the breath. You know, I really come back to my object of awareness. And because it's going to happen and it does take practice. And with time, you're able to, you know, focus for longer periods of time and not have your mind completely go wandering off, you know.
Yeah.
But it does take practice like anything that you do. And for me personally, the question is, okay, well, so why meditate, you know? And
such a good question.
Yeah, for me, it's been like, well, it's like because we do live in a society where we're completely always getting bombarded with tons of information, and we're having to process a bunch of things all at once, it feels like. Meditation for me is a time to just quiet the mind. And I felt like, and early on, I knew I was seeing some benefits in my life. Like, I felt like I was less irritable. I felt like I was more aware of what was going on in the moment, as opposed to worrying about what I'm going to do in 30 seconds from now or this afternoon or whatever, or worrying or being stuck worrying about something that happened in the past. And so I felt all of those things, and then finally we were reading this book, and the author, it was Dan Harris, he put it in words, and it finally dawned on me, oh yeah, that's exactly what I'm feeling. And it was that meditation allows you to practice, again, quieting the mind, but it actually trains your mind so when you are in the day-to-day grind, you're more likely to respond to things that are going on around you, as opposed to react.
Yes.
You know, you take it in, yes, you're able to respond to what's going on and kind of process it before you have that immediate reaction, you know, mm-hmm, and acting out.
Yeah.
And so that's why if somebody asks, well, why do I meditate? I'd say, well, that's why. I don't know. For me, it's been helpful.
That's a beautiful, that's a beautiful example of some of the purposefulness behind meditation. I think that can be actually expanded out, this idea of responding instead of reacting, because it's about being present in such a way, and that's kind of what responding is about, for at least for me, is about being aware of how I'm reacting to my environment and what my response is about. You know, is it really about the environment, or is it about something that's going on inside me? Because I can't first of all, I can't control anything, of course, out there, which is what meditation helps me to remind, like I said, as a reminder, reminds myself that I have control over nothing but myself. But also allows me to take responsibility for being present and being able to focus in the present. Absolutely. So yeah. Focus and open up my awareness to the present. Does it always work? When I work it works.
Yeah, I feel like at least in the moments for me, it helps me put things back in perspective a lot. Especially if I'm doing more of like an end of day meditation, mm-hmm, versus a beginning of day. I feel like beginning of day helps me a lot more, like with what you said about responding and not reacting and living the whole day in a way, you know, just going through the motions during the day with less anxiety, less stress and everything. But if I've kind of had some time away from meditation and then I've had maybe a stressful week and then I come to Refuge on Saturday and I haven't meditated all week, everything, all these little stressors that I let build up kind of throughout the week are all of a sudden put in perspective when I meditate. And this idea of mindfulness and even the idea of impermanence and, you know, all those things are able to settle with me a little bit more when I meditate.
Yeah.
So it's a really good time to reflect on kind of what really matters, and is it really as big of a deal as I've let it build up. You know, and that perspective shift is really helpful for me if I haven't been meditating as often. Mm-hmm. And
it doesn't take a lot of time.
No.
I kind of want to end a little bit in just a moment with about why Refuge Recovery Group Meditation is so important. But I want to say quickly that this idea of literally 5 to 10 minutes in the morning can impact my whole day. To just sit and breathe and focus, or or the lack of, you know, clearing my mind from anything. And it's usually the easiest in the morning anyway.
Mm-hmm.
But I also like it right before I go to bed. Mm-hmm. And the same kind of thing. And I don't need to take that long. I can take easily 5 minutes before I go to bed and get relaxed and pass out, you know, go to sleep very quickly. But the morning does set the context. for myself and my how I connect with that day. And I'll be honest, I don't do it every day, but about 2 months ago, I sort of made an adjustment that I was going to get up. And I've had voices around me for years saying, why don't you get up and meditate anymore? Because I used to do it with my kids when they were young, my last two kids. And they'd get up too. Dad's going to get up and meditate. And I'm just like, what? Why did I let that go? Mm-hmm. You know? And yeah, I know why. Because I thought, you know, it was too much work, and it was really the easiest thing ever to do. Once I found that place within me to do it, and that takes some time, which is why I'm going to come full circle here. So, with this in mind, and the idea of the group process of meditation in refuge, this is really a great opportunity to learn about meditation, but do it in a group. In such a mindful way that it creates a whole different type of connection. So, Brent, you were one of the founders of this group that's now a couple years in the making, and it's actually
been great.
It's a community. It's real. It's alive. It has an alive. It's a life of its own. And what are your thoughts about this?
No, for me, Refuge Recovery has just been. I know, fantastic for me to again incorporate the meditation component into my life, and it's been another tool that I've been able to utilize to help me continue my journey in recovery. And it is a community that we have, which is great. And there's something very powerful about when you're meditating in a group, and there's an energy to it, I guess, you know, not to get all hippy-dippy, I guess, but, you know.
No, but it's empirical. This has been empirically studied over and over and over again, that a community of people meditating together, the impact that it has on their lives and the lives of their families. It's been shown to have significant effects on the well-being of themselves and their families and their work and their job and everything.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it just, there's an energy to it, and it's a guided meditation. So when you're first starting out in learning about meditation and doing it, it kind of facilitates you getting on that path to where you can start to incorporate a meditation by yourself.
Mm-hmm.
Start a daily practice, you know.
Yeah.
So it's been great, and a lot of the concepts, it's a Buddhist approach. It takes Buddhist principles and applies that to recovery.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of those Buddhist principles are just so, I think, are just so valuable to somebody that's in recovery. And really, basically, for anybody, life, essentially. You don't even have to be in recovery, really. But, just to learn some of the concepts.
Or from drugs and alcohol. Can be any type of obsessive, compulsive behavior.
Any type of addiction,
any type.
So, I don't know. It's been fantastic. I really... Yeah. So happy that we started a group, through Wasatch.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. It's
good.
And now it has it's a life of its own.
It is. Yeah.
It is birth. It has been given birth. Yeah. We'll come back and talk more about meditation from different aspects because, and maybe we should do a guided meditation on one of these.
That's interesting. Yeah.
I mean, just think about it. I think it would be. It would, we could actually start with it and then discuss it, and just like we would in a meeting.
In a refuge meeting,
Cool. I think that it's, we're talking about how to do it. I mean, actually, why don't we just do it?
Right.
It seems like that's a saying from somewhere, if I remember. Just do it. Yeah, okay. All right.
Never heard of it.
All right. Thank you all for being with us this week. We will talk to you real soon. Have a great week, and we'll go out as we usually do with a little Joan Osborne.